This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Well, back in December, we talked with Ricardo Garcia from the University of Central Florida's Business Incubation Program. Garcia is a veteran, and he was launching a program to help other veteran entrepreneurs. He joins us now for an update on how that program is going. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by retired U.S. Air Force veteran Derek Bug. He's working on a business to help children and adults with intellectual disabilities. Thank you for joining us as well.
Well, thank you.
I want to start with you. What's your business about, and why did you want to focus on what you're doing now?
What I'd like to do is start a business where I can train veterans and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities on how to be stable hands, how to work on a farm. I've been working with people with intellectual disabilities for 17 years. I've actually done that before. But I started doing some research into it, and I realized that there are jobs out there for people like that. For example, about a month ago, there was a job opening where this family had a farm, and they said you can live in one of their houses for free. You can cable was free, and all they wanted you to do was take care of the animals. And I started thinking, why couldn't that be one of our young vets coming back, or why couldn't that be, you know, maybe one of our older vets that's lost his way, you know? So that's my motivation in pursuing this.
So it sounds like you've got two sort of different ideas or two different
different target groups for this. Like I said, I've worked with people with disabilities before. I enjoy that work. There's no reason why they can't learn how to do this kind of work. Like I said, I've taught them before. And then there's a third component. I want to work with, have a day camp during the summer and work with kids. Maybe 1 week could be kids with anxiety. 1 week could be kids that get bullied, you know, and just kind of, you know, help them in their personal development and social skills.
So you've got some land, you've got a little ranch in Central Florida.
I do.
Tell me about that.
It's a little 5-acre place in Umatilla, Florida, out in the middle of nowhere. It's very therapeutic. I mean, when I originally moved back here from Arizona, I originally was going to like find a little flat in Mount Dora, but then I saw this property and it just overwhelmed me. I have 3 horses. I have 2 goats for now. All that's going to increase. I'm looking for some miniature horses to work with, maybe the smaller kids. A couple of dogs, and it's like I said, it's a very therapeutic place. It's a very nice place.
So the vision for this business in your mind would be have the kids or the veterans, whoever it is, like riding horses, learning how to take care of them?
No, that part of the business where we actually train them to work on a farm, it's not about riding, although they probably will have to learn how to ride. I have a horse specialist, over 30 years of experience working with horses. She can teach people how to ride. She was certified to teach people how to ride. Her name is Danielle. And she's amazing. And her and I have done work for, like I said, the last, you know, since 2003, we started actually training people. And riding will be a big component of it. But as far as taking care of the farm, that would be the biggest component. I mean, like I said, there are some jobs out there like that. But as far as working with the kids, you know, in the summertime for my little day camp, you know, there won't be any riding in that program either. There'll be more hands-on working with the animals and just doing activities to build up self-confidence.
Mm-hmm. You went through this business incubator course.
I did.
How was that? What was that experience like?
It was amazing. It was just simply amazing. I had this idea. I have this idea. I didn't know where to go with it. I was fortunate enough to get accepted into the program, and what I found was much more than I expected. Not only did they help me learn how to start a business, but they also, you know, I had a lot of, you know, peers in there, a lot of people in there that actually had their own businesses that gave me very solid advice. They encouraged me. A couple of them actually came out to my ranch and helped me out there, you know.
Oh, really? They,
and has volunteered to come out and do some more stuff out there. So, you know, I it's just the overwhelming feeling that I got from being in this class and with my classmates and with, you know, with our mentors here.
Mm-hmm. Ricardo, did the course kind of pan out the way you thought it would?
Yes, it did. And actually it was way better than we expected. I think it was overwhelming to hear. It was really inspiring to see all the veterans at the end of the course coming together. The peer mentoring that occurred was something that we expected to some degree, but it was much larger than we thought. The camaraderie, the feeling of them, what they got out of the program was really great. Was really inspiring, and so. It went as we planned, and I think it exceeded our expectations.
Do you think that sense of camaraderie is something unique to veterans? Because, you know, they've gone through the military, and that sort of builds its own sense of camaraderie. So a course like this, you would expect sort of a little more cohesion anyway?
Yes, I think we expected that. It was definitely great being a veteran as well. I didn't realize this, but I definitely missed that camaraderie. I think we only get that when we're active duty, when we're there, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in the civilian world, it can be challenging. But right. Being able to come together with like-minded veteran entrepreneurs was a great experience. So.
And you had, what, 27 people in the course?
We had 27 successfully graduate the program. Mm-hmm. So we started with 40, and some decided that perhaps entrepreneurship was not the right path to take. And we see that as a good thing. We helped them realize that quickly without expending whatever resources they had at their disposal. So, or maybe it wasn't the right time. But, mm-hmm. But yes, successfully we had 27 complete the program. Different stages of business. We had some at the growth stage. Others that were at the idea stage, and those at the growth stage, it allowed them to focus working on their business rather than in the business. So mm-hmm. thinking outside the box, thinking strategically. Those at the idea stage were, I think, got a lot of peer mentoring from pitfalls they could potentially avoid, and a lot of peer mentoring is what mm-hmm. we saw as well.
Were there a lot of folks in the course who are fresh out of active duty?
Yes, we had some that transitioned out of the military, you know, within months. Some that are still reserve, and we had others as far back as Vietnam veterans. So wow. it was a great mix of veterans.
Mm-hmm. And is that where the mentoring comes in? Like some of that mentoring that comes from people who are actually taking the course, mentoring each other.
Yes.
Derek Bug, what was that mix like for you? What was it like mixing it up with folks who are maybe still in the reserve or have come back from active duty fairly recently?
You know, it didn't matter who they were or how long they had been in the service, whether young or old. They all had something to offer. For example, there's a young man in there who's got to be at least, you know, 20 years younger than me, who's past the idea phase, starting his own business. And, you know, he taught me a lot. He just encouraged me. He showed me some of the pitfalls. He actually lives really close to where I live at. So it didn't matter. It really didn't matter, you know, as far as that. It was there. The camaraderie was there. Mm-hmm. I learned from everybody. And I hope somebody might have learned something from me, too.
You hear about the challenges that can sometimes face a returning veteran trying to integrate back into civilian life. Is that something that you went through coming out of the military?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate to get a job working for a company that had a contract with the military. So my transition was nice, but there are some people that come out and they don't have that transition. They don't have anybody to mentor them, you know, but like I said, I was fortunate. So yeah, it can be very difficult. And I went through some of it, but not quite as much as everybody else did.
Mm-hmm. This program would be good for folks who might be facing a bit of a challenge trying to figure out what to do next.
Absolutely. The incubation program is perfect for something like that. Absolutely. That way, like he said, they'll know whether they want to do something like this or not.
Ricardo, what was the most surprising thing for you about this course?
I think the how fast the veterans came together, the willingness to help each other out. Mm-hmm. I think that was the most surprising thing for me. Like Rick mentioned, there was no rank, there was no age, no boundaries. Basically, it was just veteran entrepreneurs looking to come together to help move their businesses along, whether they're at the idea stage or they're looking to scale their businesses. Mm-hmm. It was a great camaraderie.
Ricardo, part of the course was a Shark Tank type of competition. Was it difficult sort of having your vets go through that and having to pick one person from that process?
Yes, it was very difficult, especially because they were at different business stages. So what we did was we broke them out into three tiers based on their business stage. We had some that were at the idea stage, the other one was at the startup stage, and the third was at the growth stage. Mm-hmm. And then we brought in a panel of judges, which were veteran entrepreneurs in the community. Some were veteran, others were just successful entrepreneurs in the community to do the judging. And the idea was to help provide them positive feedback, mm-hmm. how they can improve their business presentations. And they we were able to get offer them a 1-year membership to the UCF Business Incubation Program as the prize for those three.
Do you anticipate some veterans might come back and do this course again if it's still on offer?
Yes, definitely. So it was great working with in partnership with Veterans Florida, and we anticipate doing this again next January. And between now and January, we plan on doing workshops to bring the alumni back together, perhaps on a monthly basis, a topic of interest, whether it be, you know, intellectual property law or bringing in somebody from the SBA. That's our goal, is to do something that can help them continue working on their business, and then also help them come back together and hear what milestones they've achieved, what pivots they've made, that type of thing.
So some of the things that you might be building into the course down the track is stuff like ideas, questions that have come up in the original iteration of this course.
Exactly.
As for next steps, I mean, you had some funding to get this started. Where are you at as far as getting more funding to keep this program going?
Yes, so we have a great relationship with the state, Veterans Florida. We're grateful for that. There's 7 other educational institutions throughout the state that are offering the program as well. Throughout the state, there was 147 veteran entrepreneurs that graduated the program. And so we hope to continue that partnership with Veterans Florida. We also would like to explore sponsorship opportunities and partnerships with corporations or foundations throughout the community that would like to help continue the success of this program.
How do you see veteran entrepreneurship fitting into the sort of bigger picture of veteran employment overall in Florida?
So I think by helping them, we can help create jobs and generate revenue, tax revenue, and throughout the community. And the UCF Business Incubation Program has been successful at doing that. We've helped over 350 companies that has yielded a high economic impact to the region. And so I think a skill set that the veterans bring to the table is that the mission-driven mentality, the attention to detail. And so if we help them, we can definitely help our communities grow and thrive.
So is the idea for veteran business owners, veteran entrepreneurs to stay in Florida and stay here, or do you see them sort of branching out and going elsewhere?
Absolutely. We'd love to keep them here in the region. Throughout Florida, and we want to even invite veterans from other parts of the country to come to Florida. You know, Florida is a great place to not just to live, but also to thrive. We have a great entrepreneurial ecosystem, and I think it's a great place.
Derek Bug, what would your advice be to other veterans who want to launch a business, or maybe in the situation you were, you know, back in the 90s when you were coming out of the armed forces?
I would completely suggest they go through this program. We all have ideas on how business should start, and you can read all types of things on the internet. But what they taught us is something that I would have never picked up out of a book, you know, or never, you know, found on the internet. And like I said before, between what they taught us in the program and what my peers in the program has taught me, it's really important to have that kind of organization when you're learning something. So I would suggest to new veterans, you know, go through the program. It's really important that they go through something like this and learn, you know, and learn the correct way at that.
How far off is your dream for this business now? Like, how much more work do you have to do to set it in motion?
What I need to do is find, is contact somebody from like APD, the Agency of Personal Disabilities, to try and figure out, you know, how I'm going to make this work. You know, there is a need for it. I spoke to people at the group home level, and they would love to send people my way, but I don't know how that works. I would also need to get a hold of somebody that within, you know, the VA and tell them, hey, I'm willing to train some vets. You know, I just don't know how to do what the next step is. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm going to start trying to make some of those phone calls next week and, you know, and get a hold of somebody and just reach out. You know, so I don't know where that they are, but I'll find them.
Derek Bug, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I was really glad to be here.
We're also joined by Ricardo Garcia. Ricardo, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ricardo Garcia is the Government Resources Manager for UCF's Business Incubation Program, and Derek Bug is a retired US Air Force veteran looking to launch a business to help veterans and developmentally challenged children and adults. From veteran entrepreneurs to space entrepreneurs, the commercial space race is a key part of the economy in North Brevard County. We spoke to Troy Post, Executive Director of the North Brevard Economic Development Zone, about what's driving the economy.
We've also got businesses that are in the marine industry that are doing well, and also in the healthcare industry that are doing well. So several different sectors, but certainly commercial-driven space is doing very well right now for us.
And Port Canaveral is now getting in on the act too, right? I'd note that SpaceX is going to move into some warehousing there, a pretty big space too, 53,000-some feet, an office facility at the port. That's kind of a big deal for them.
Yeah, we're really excited about what's going on, again, with not just that company, but some of the other commercial aerospace firms like Blue Origin, the satellite manufacturing firm OneWeb. A lot of these companies are relying upon the logistics that are possible through Port Canaveral. And, you know, the port itself is an economic driver, not just with what they're doing with commercial aerospace, but also with the cruise industry and their plans for doing commercial cargo. So, yeah, all of that stuff is very exciting for us, and it's all adding to, I think, a lot of very good development news.
When you sort of take a look back at the last couple of years, what's changed for the North Brevard Economic Development Zone?
Well, we would like to think that we've been responsible for helping to incentivize some deals that may not have otherwise gone to this area. So I think that's been one big key. I think our work with the local Economic Development Commission has been another big factor. They've done a very good job of trying to market the area, trying to recruit some firms to come in that were not here previously. I think that, again, what's going on with the port and what they're doing with their logistics trade, that's a big part of this as well. And, you know, we continue to benefit from tourism, ecotourism here in the northern end and really throughout all of Brevard County. So it's just a combination of several different things that I think are making a big difference locally.
Do you have the kind of talent you need as far as the workforce goes to keep some of these businesses going, or are you looking to recruit more people to the area to sustain those businesses?
Well, yes, that's always one of the challenges. You know, do we have the labor pool to serve all of the needs of these firms? I know that working with the Brevard Career Source and also with, again, the EDC, they're working to try to market the area, trying to bring in talent. We're also working with the local labor pool to make sure that there are sufficient training opportunities available to them so that they can qualify for some of these jobs that will come up soon. So it's a constant process trying to find the right talent to come into the area and also trying to make sure that the people who are here are equipped with the kind of skills necessary to land some of these jobs.
What are some of the other challenges that you are facing as you look to develop the talent and develop the businesses in the area?
Well, for us in the northern end, one of the challenges that we continue to encounter, we don't have a lot of land that is really available for development. A lot of it is federal sector controlled land, either at Kennedy or just in some of the wildlife areas that surround us. So we want to try to do what we can to redevelop existing commercial areas, industrial areas, and are searching constantly to find properties. These are building properties, maybe vacant land parcels that could be used for development. We really do see a time in the near future where it may be very difficult for us to be able to accommodate the kind of firms that may want to be here unless we prepare now for that infrastructure.
Is there also a need for residential development? Like, do you have a lot of people moving to the area for work, and is that a challenge too?
Yeah, it's a very good question. We know that there is a lot of residential construction that's taking place in the central part of the county, certainly over in Orange County, some of the surrounding areas. In the northern part of the county over here in Brevard, haven't seen a very significant increase in that. There is some new housing construction that's going on more in existing subdivisions, maybe lots that were not developed back 10 years ago or so. What we're really looking for is maybe some new subdivisions to start coming online up in the northern area, which can provide a wide range of housing, everything from somewhere, you know, that would appeal to a moderate income to maybe a higher income type of individual.
Just finally, when you look at Titusville, the city of Titusville, how is that changing as some of these new developments spring up and some of these new businesses come into the area? Has the flavor of the city changed at all?
You know, I think the community still likes feel of it being a small town community, but certainly we do see a lot more growth on the horizon. I think people much more confident up here than they were a few years ago when the shuttle was idled. And of course, NASA went through some of the layoffs that it did. NASA is still going well. It's at a reduced workforce compared to where it was maybe 10 years ago, but there's still a lot going on that's federal sector driven aerospace. But I think the people in the community really feel like the future is very bright. You hear that in some of the things that are said. And you see it in a lot of small business development that's starting to take off over here, too.
Troy Post, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Troy Post is the executive director of the North Brevard Economic Development Zone. Still to come.
I have probably one of the best disaster kits in my entire neighborhood, and I'm not even going to be home during the event. I'll be at the Emergency Operations Center.
Hurricane season starts this week. Are you prepared? Don't miss an episode of Intersection. You can download the podcast, find it on iTunes or the NPR One app, or wherever you download your podcasts. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Alan Harris is the emergency manager with Seminole County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So we're heading into hurricane season. It's predicted to be a more active than normal hurricane season. What does that tell you in terms of what people need to be aware of as far as preparation goes?
Well, here in Seminole County, and I think most emergency management offices throughout the state of Florida, we are praying for no hurricane, of course, but we are planning for the response of a major hurricane hitting the state of Florida. Here in Seminole County, we are planning for a Category 4 hurricane coming in the Brevard-Volusia County line and going directly over Seminole County. We assume if we plan for an event like that, that we, of course, planning for the worst, hoping for the best, that we will be better prepared for an emergency if one was to occur.
When Hurricane Matthew grazed the state last year, did that do some damage in Seminole County?
It did. We had 900 homes damaged in the Hurricane Matthew event. Two homes were destroyed in that event. We had some major damage to some homes. Infrastructure was damaged. We had 72,000 customers without power, and power was not fully restored until 2.5 weeks after the event. So even though we did not experience hurricane force winds here in Seminole County, we did experience the tropical winds and the flooding event as the storm went by.
So that was a bit of a wake-up call for your residents?
It certainly was, and I will say it was a reminder for us in the first response community and government as a whole of what we experienced in 2004 during Charlie, Francis, and Jean. While it was no way even close to the extent of damage that we received in 2004, it certainly was a reminder to us of all the different types of activities that we need to be able to deal with, we need to be able to respond to. And it also taught us something new, and that is our community is much faster paced now. They are used to getting news immediately. We need to be faster in how we communicate to the public because there are so many different ways and so many different forms of communication, certainly radio being one of the most tried and true forms of communication, and that's why we're partnering with your station this year as we did last year and multiple years before in trying to get that information out as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Do you find that more of your residents now, though, would be looking to social media to get information about a storm?
Absolutely. Well, and we have to have a multimodal approach of how we provide information. So we are providing information, of course, to our traditional media partners, as well as through Facebook and Twitter and other types of means, Nextdoor, and those other type of social media outlets.
So tell me about what kind of flooding hazards you have to deal with that are specific to Seminole County, because you've got the St. John's River sort of wending its way through the county, right? And that can be a challenge even when there's not a hurricane, if you've got a heavy rain event.
Absolutely. So we have the localized flooding issues initially. So as Matthew went by, those low-lying areas, the tributaries to the St. John's, some lakes that were relatively high at that particular point. Now, because of our drought, they're a little bit low. But if we get a couple tropical events, a tropical depression maybe and a tropical storm, or the rains in the afternoon, we could certainly be back at that level that we were when Matthew went through. So that's our first event, is the localized flooding. And then as the tributaries go into the St. John's River, the St. John's River bottlenecks at the north part of Sanford and Lake Monroe. So we do see some flooding along the St. John's River. We also see some debris often with these types of events, and there was debris in the St. John's River. And actually, some of our northern counties, thank God, not Seminole County, but certainly our northern counties, Clay County, Putnam County, are still dealing with debris in the St. John's River.
I'm wondering if there's an upside to the impending hurricane season. Of course, the state's been in the grip of a drought for some months now, so a bit of rain is probably quite welcome at this point.
Certainly, we would, in some ways, we would welcome a tropical depression, not a tropical storm, not a hurricane, but a tropical depression certainly would bring us the needed rainfall. We did, of course, experience some rainfall over the last couple weeks, but that was in no way a match to the amount of drought that we've had over the last quite a few months. So we need a lot more rain, even to get back to normal levels in the Central Florida area.
Just back to the flooding issues that Seminole County has to deal with. I was speaking to you a year or two back, and you're talking about some of the infrastructure changes that were going on along the river, right, as far as redoing some of the docks along the St. John's. Can you tell me what happened there and how that's now better suited to cope with a flood event?
Absolutely. We've done a lot of mitigation efforts. Certainly with flooding, we have raised the boat ramps, the docks that go out there, added floating docks to those areas. And the reason that we did that is we do experience flooding-type conditions in tropical events and right after tropical events. If it's safe, though, to travel along the St. John's River, we want the parks to remain open, and we want business to continue. There are a number of different businesses, airboat businesses and fishing businesses that deal with customers that want to get on the St. John's River, want to experience Florida's natural choice, Seminole County's motto. And we certainly want to allow them to do that if it's safe to do so. So we've done those mitigation efforts to hopefully keep those parks back open. We were able to keep the parks open during Hurricane Matthew, and commerce continued shortly after the event.
So for folks who maybe haven't prepared for a hurricane, there are going to be some, of course, listening to this. What should they have in their preparation kit?
Sure. So we say do four things when preparing for this upcoming hurricane season. And we just had a hurricane expo at the mall. And what we saw during that was there were a lot of people that came by the booths that just moved into the area. So whether you're a newcomer to the Central Florida area or you've been around for a little while, the four items are get a plan. Know where you're going to go. Know what type of medications you and your family members are on. Have those insurance documents prepared. Get a kit. The kit should have non-perishable foods, small tools, items that you would need around the home, flashlights, batteries, and a transistor radio. A radio that you can listen to this station for up-to-date information from the local emergency operations centers. Have a stay informed. Make sure that you have a weather radio and also a portable radio that you can listen to this station again for information. And then the last is volunteer. So if you can get a plan, get a kit, stay informed, and if you have the capability and are willing, volunteer, we can, as a community, be better prepared and respond better to a hurricane.
Do you find also, Alan Harris, there's a run on things like chainsaws, generators, other kind of hardware items around this time of year?
Sure. And if you're going to get a generator, that's fine. Practice generator safety. It depends on your income level, your willingness to purchase those types of things, whether you get a small generator just to power maybe a refrigerator freezer or a window air conditioning unit, or a large generator to power your home. If you're going to do some protection around the home, you can go the cheaper route, buying some marine plywood and things like that, or you can go for the whole shutter systems if that is what you wish to do. And then, of course, around the home, just making sure that you do some tree trimming and things like that is also a great thing to do. If you are going to get chainsaws and those types of things, please make sure that you practice with those. We had some injuries right after Hurricane Matthew. People had bought some brand new chainsaws, never practiced with them before, and the fire units were having to respond to emergency calls for people that cranked up those chainsaws for the first time right after Hurricane Matthew. So get some practice in prior to the storm. There are some home hardware stores that do those types of training classes. Get in on one of those free training classes.
And then as far as generator safety, there's sometimes cases where people are running their generator inside, or they've got it in the garage and the garage is closed. Things can go wrong, right?
Absolutely. We did have some carbon monoxide poisoning right after Hurricane Matthew, people wanting to secure their generators, but they secured them in the wrong location. Inside a home is not where you secure the generator. Inside the garage, not where you secure a generator. It needs to be outside. If you want to secure it to a tree or something like that, that's fine, but definitely not inside.
Finally, Alan Harris, is your kit up to date? Do you still need to buy a couple of things to go in there?
That's a great question. I never suggest that everybody go out and buy everything all at once. I work for the government. I don't get paid a lot, so I wouldn't expect anyone to do anything that I don't do. Instead, what I do is each time I go to the hardware store, each time I go to the grocery store, I buy a couple extra items. Those items go into a plastic container. I have probably one of the best disaster kits in my entire neighborhood, and I'm not even going to be home during the event. I'll be at the emergency operations center. So each time you go to the hardware store, each time you go to the grocery store, buy a couple extra items. You'll have a nice disaster kit in short order.
Do you have an Instagram account, Alan Harris? I'm wondering if you could maybe post some pictures of the best disaster kit in Seminole County so people can take a look.
I should probably do that. That would be fun to do. I could do that. I'll see about doing that.
Well, Alan Harris is the Seminole County Emergency Manager. Thank you so much for your time, Alan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next.
When I see the librarians and the things that they have done all these years before I came in, they've actually been social workers before I came in, because they've been linking the people to the resources and the information.
Dr. Stem Malatini is a social worker. You might see her at an Orange County Public Library branch. So why is the library system putting a social worker on staff? Find out after the break. If you missed an episode of Intersection, find us online. Listen back at wmfe.org/intersection. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orange County Public Libraries just added a new staff member. Meet Dr. Stem.
My name is Stembile Malatini, but I go by Stem or Dr. Stem.
On Tuesdays, Dr. Stem works out of an office at the downtown Orlando Public Library. The position is funded through Institute of Museum and Library Services, or IMLS money, and there's a question mark about that funding under the White House budget. But why does the library need a social worker on staff?
Just like the patrons, you know, are actually saying that we needed a social worker a long time ago, because library services, what we do is we provide information. So what I bring now through our program, The Right Services at the Right Time, is bridging the gap. I now am the person that can help them take the information and make it into an action. That way they, you know, they have a service. So I actually help apply for food stamps, just like, you know, before you came in, I had someone that wanted, you know, help applying for food stamps on the computer. And I also find resources for homeless, you know, homeless people that are looking for homes and jobs. And I have people that come in for general information. I have a child that needs, you know, tutoring. Where can I find that? And we have all the resources at the right time, at the right services on our website.
So these are some questions that
other library staff might have been asked before you came on scene?
They are continuing to be asked. So then these are questions that they get asked, and it takes a little bit of time for them to be able to access those services and to help out. So now they don't have to, you know, do a lot, because what they do is when I'm on site, I'm in 5 different libraries. So when I'm on site, if somebody asks, you know, for information, they, you know, quick to say there's a social worker there, and I can sit in for 30 minutes, an hour to help someone, you know, get to the services that they need and link them with those services.
How long have you been working in the Orange County Library System?
2nd week, but I have 22 years of experience as a licensed clinical social worker as well as a, you know, social worker in the field.
What's that last couple of weeks been like? Like, who have you seen? Who have you helped out?
I have helped out in the Central Library. We have a lot of our homeless patrons that are looking for work or looking to extend their food stamps or looking for resources to go to another shelter, because then they have limited time in certain shelters. So most of the time they're coming in wanting to find another shelter to go to. That's in the Central Library. In the other libraries I've had, as I said, parents that came in, you know, they are in their shelter but they need resources for helping their children. I have one patron that, you know, I won't forget. She came in with a whole list of questions because she has elder parents that she's taking care of that needed resources. And she says, can you help me link my parents with resources as well as, you know, for herself looking for work? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of people are hearing about it, and they are now starting to come out. And actually, we've created a, you know, a list where people have to, you know, to be registered in order for them to see me, because I couldn't see everybody. Like last week, we had a lot of people, you know, lined up outside the doors, because now they know that there's a service at the library where they have a social worker in the library.
And this is the first library in the state of Florida, as you said, to have a social worker here. Where did this idea come from? Does it happen elsewhere in the states? Do you know?
We have a program. It's called the Right Services at the Right Time. And this program actually has resources, as I mentioned before, where we help out people with daily needs, housing, health care, family assistance, immigration, jobs. And in the grant that we have provision in there where we had said we're bringing in a social worker, and that's all we're doing now, fulfilling the grant needs that, you know, we have a social worker that will actually sit on the computer and now help the patrons log in and actually apply for the services so that they can get the services. Because sometimes just getting the information is a challenge for somebody who doesn't, you know how to use the computer to say, okay, now I know where to go or what to do on the computer, but I don't know how to log in. So now they have me who's actually able to log in for them and help them create an account and teach them how to access it. That way, when they come to the library now, they can log in themselves and, you know, get the information that they need.
You're not just at the Central Library here, the downtown Orlando Library. You're also at some of the other libraries around the system. Are you spread too thin? Like, do you wish there were another social worker as well to help you out?
We're actually wishing we have more social workers than just one person. Yes, on Mondays, I'm at the Hiawassee branch from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesdays, I'm at the Central Library from 8 a.m., 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And then Wednesdays, Alifair from 10 to 7. Thursdays, Southeast Branch, 10 to 7. Fridays, I'm at South Trail from 10 to 5 p.m. So, yes, there's a need for more social workers and more assistance.
Are you finding the same kinds of questions at each branch?
There are different kinds of questions, but you know what? Most of them are consistent with needing help with food stamps or applications or resources in the community to serve different needs, you know, for the people. But I think it's consistent that a lot of people have the same needs in all libraries.
And how long are you going to be doing this for? Like, how long does the grant go for?
You're asking somebody that wants to do this for life, because then it's a service that we need, that is needed. So I think, you know what, because we are providing a service that, you know, is much needed in the community, you know, because it goes by need. So as long as we are using, you know, the service to help the people in the community, the grants, you know, hopefully, and we are praying that it continues, because there is a great need for more than one social worker, a whole department, because other states, you know, and I've been doing research before I even came here on other states that have social workers in the library. They now have departments of social services within the library system so that they could have more people working in the library. So, you know, one of the things that we can do is also utilize, you know, the university. We have social workers at the university that are always looking for internship. And what a great idea to bring in, you know, interns to help out in the system as well. So that's part of what we would ask for in a grant if, you know, we're going to renew this.
You might get some interns at some point down the track?
Well, I'm a qualified supervisor in the state of Florida, so I supervise interns anywhere before I came here. So my intention is to create a program where we can have interns coming in into the library systems. That way, also, we can serve other libraries within the system rather than just the five that one person is doing right now.
Are you hoping other libraries will look at what's going on here and say it's a great idea, let's do that as well?
Well, right now, we just started last week, so we're hoping that, you know, we can spread the word and people can see the right things. We have a survey that I'm going around, you know, when I serve someone, I ask them if they're okay with giving us, you know, any feedback and any ideas. And a lot of them have been saying, well, you can't just be here one day. We need you 5 days a week. So hopefully with that need and people voicing that, you know, that will help us to also have other libraries have a social worker in there.
Isn't it kind of mind-boggling, though, to think that a library is now the place where you go to get this? I mean, it's become way more than just a place to go check out a book or a movie or something.
Yeah, for a social worker, it's not mind-boggling because then, you know, for social services, what I think about when people come to the library, they are looking for information that can help them in their day-to-day lives or even, you know, when they're down, they're looking for something that can lift them up. So to have a social worker that they can come in and say, look, I'm looking for a job, but do you think my resume looks good? And then I go, well, what have you done? And I look at the resume and say, you know what, maybe if we add that you did babysit from what year to what year, that's going to help you out. That alone helped boost their energy and, you know, I mean, comfort level of looking for a job, that they are now, you know, even more, you know, motivated to find that job because they've spoken to somebody who believes in them, who's also encouraging them to go out and find something. So I like the fact that, you know, now we can have families and, you know, I walk around the library and go to the teenage sections and, you know, I mean, the children's sections and talk to the parents there because I'm a resource for families as well. So I think it's a great resource and a great change, you know.
When you don't have somebody in here, when you're interviewing them one-on-one, you're just wandering around, chatting
just
to people?
Just wandering around and introducing myself because a lot of people don't know that we have the service. So I'm going around introducing myself. And, you know, yesterday I was in Hiawassee and one gentleman says, well, you can tell me what you do, but, you know, I don't think I need it. The minute I said, well, you know, I work with the right services at the right time and it's a website that we have with resources that we connect with people. And some of the things that I help with is, you know, housing, finance. And he says, oh, housing. I'm looking for housing. And I said, no. This is not for you, remember? You don't need it. So then we laughed about it, and then he says, no, seriously, I need help finding housing for elderly because I'm over 60 and I want something that, you know, they house people over 60. And, you know, I mean, what a service, because then I was able to find him a list of about 5-6 communities, made a phone call, see if he needs an appointment to go and, you know, take a look and have, you know, a meeting with someone there. And before he knew it, he took the bus yesterday. He's like, that's not what I wanted to do today, but I have to do this. But it was exciting that he was able to get a service that he wasn't expecting, but now he's going to tell other people to say, guess what? There's a lady out there, a social worker in the library that can help you out. She helped me find a place and they'll be coming in.
Have you ever been asked a question you couldn't answer?
I'm a researcher by heart as well, and if I can't, the good thing about being a social worker is I can tell you that I don't know, but let's find out together. And that's always exciting for people to say, what, you don't know? And I say, no, I don't, but guess what? Let's find out together. So if it's not on our Right Services website, I'm, you know, going in and calling some places, I'm calling my supervisors. I have two supervisors that I can call, you know, and at the heartbeat and say, hey, I'm not quite sure what to do. Where can you find this? And between the three of us, we find those answers quick, you know. So there's nothing that I don't know.
So, Dr. Stem, you're kind of like a human Google. You're a human search engine.
Yes, I am a human Google. And you know what? With Google, sometimes Google doesn't know, and Google will say, I don't know. Wait, did you mean this? And it gives you a suggestion. And that's what I do with the people. Sometimes they come up with an idea of what they're looking for, but within our conversations, they tend to say, you know what? I never thought of it that way. And then, boom, they leave here with new information that they didn't know about themselves.
What does it tell you, though, about the library sort of ecosystem that it is now? It does now include social work as part of the service that it provides. I mean, does it tell you something about the way this whole system is evolving and developing?
I think it shows about the openness and the willingness to serve the whole person, not just to give information, you know, that is educational, but now we're serving people, you know, in their lives as well, social life and emotional life, because then, you know, as we do this here mentally, I'm able to also assess people and say maybe you might even need to talk to a therapist or a counselor that might help you, because then I have some people last week that came in on the South Trail and talking about domestic violence and said, you know, I don't think I'm safe where I am. So with that, I'm able to give those resources that, you know, can help them even with their emotional needs. So it says a lot about the library saying, you know what, we do have the books, we do have the information, but now we can help you access them and make it okay for you to access the services that are in the community.
If you weren't a social worker, do you think you'd be a librarian?
I am a librarian. You see, and that's what I think. When I see the librarians and the things that they have done all these years before I came in, they've actually been social workers before I came in, because they've been linking the people to the resources and the information. And unfortunately, it was just a lot, you know, for them to be able to do that. So I think I come in as an extension of the library services. So just like they are social workers, I think I'm a librarian as well, because then what I don't know, I send it to the librarians as far as, you know, the books and where the information is, and then when it comes to accessing the resources, they send them to me. So it intertwines, I think.
Sounds like you're enjoying yourself here, though.
I really love what I do. I really love what I do, because the difference is when somebody walks in and they say, you know what, they told me to come here, but I don't know what to do. And I say, okay, you know, sit down, let's see, let's figure out what you need to do. And they can literally leave here saying, you know what, I feel good about where I'm going, and I know I'm going to get the answers, because, you know, you've done the legwork of helping me, you know, access the information that I need. And to see their face and the relaxation that they have to say, you know what, okay, now I know, you know, what to do. Go and take bus number 3, because literally I'll say, you need to go to this agency. Let me find out what bus number you need and give them bus number 3. Are you okay? Yep, here's the address. Just in case you forget that it's bus number 3 and the information I've given you here, and they can leave saying, I'm going to bus number 3. Or if they say, I don't remember, oh, she gave me the address. Where do you think, what bus number do you think I can take? You know, that's what excites me, to make sure that the people have the answers, you know, to the questions that they come in here with. Because every day we are bombarded with people coming in to look for information. So now not only do they have information, they now have means and ways to have action and actually get, you know, their answers, you know, answered and fulfilled in, you know, getting jobs or going back to school. I mean, anything that they need, we now can help them to say, you know what, you can apply this way, you can go to this place, you can ask for information there. And sometimes I have a phone in here. I have to make the phone call for them because they're too scared, or they say, I don't know what to say. Don't worry, I'll do it for you. So those are some of the things that I'm having fun doing.
Well, Dr. Stem Malatini, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for this, you know, time. And I hope that, you know, I can get to meet all the people that are listening in, you know, on the station today, to meet them in the different libraries and just come and say, hi, we heard you on the radio, so that we can, you know, serve them as well.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Talia Blake. Find the Intersection podcast on iTunes, the NPR One app, or wherever you download your podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.